Hi, everyone. I think we're still admitting people, but we're going to make a start now. So welcome to the LSE Department of Law, the virtual LSE Department of Law for this online event. I'm Abhinav Subempa. I am an assistant professor in the law department, and I'm chairing today's online event. So again, thank you all for joining us. This is the first of two webinars which we're holding on the topic of lay participation in criminal proceedings. The second webinar will be the same time next week, and hopefully you'll all be able to join us again for that. Also, just to note that this is being recorded for a podcast, which will be released shortly, subject to any technical difficulties. And if anyone is tweeting and you'd like to tag us, you're welcome to tag us using the hashtag LSECrim, so LSECrim. Now, some of you will know that this was originally planned as a one-day sort of symposium or conference to take place back in April. And the plan was and remains to bring together academics, legal practitioners, people that work in the courts, policymakers, representatives from NGOs, anyone who has an interest in this topic, in order to encourage critical engagement with the concept of lay participation. So what does it mean for defendants, complainants, witnesses to participate in court? Why is it important to have their participation? What barriers to meaningful participation exist? How well are we doing at addressing those barriers currently? And what more can or should we do? Now, since we couldn't have this as a physical event, we decided to turn it into an online event. And rather than having a full day of Zoom, which probably isn't great for anyone, we've divided it into a two-part seminar series. And we wanted to continue with it because this is a timely issue. So even before lockdown, the questions I just posed were deserving of more and broader consideration. We have, on the one hand, ongoing efforts to increase effective participation, particularly of vulnerable individuals in court proceedings. And then at the same time, we're seeing court closures, we're seeing the government's court modernization program, which will include greater use of technology, which will affect the way in which people participate. Now, in many ways, the current pandemic and the lockdown has made this an even more urgent topic to be considered. The plans for greater use of technology have been expedited, so virtual hearings have sort of become the norm over the last couple of months. We're now also seeing socially distanced jury trials and suggestions that maybe we just shouldn't have jury trials. So it's important that we think about how individuals participate and why this is important and how this can be facilitated at a time where there might be particular factors impeding participation. I also just wanted to acknowledge the relevance of the current Black Lives Matter movement and the anti-racist protests in respect of this topic. Now, I have to confess that I was and remain pessimistic that we will see long-term change and actual real commitments to sort of ridding our institutions and our systems of racism, including the criminal justice system, which is quite possibly the most racist of all of our systems. I hope I'm wrong in my pessimism. And I have seen in over the past week in particular, more lawyers being vocal, more firms and chambers releasing statements of commitments to do better. If we are serious about redressing inequalities and racism in our criminal justice system, that should include consideration of particular factors which can impede participation for particular groups of people. So with Black people in particular, as the focus at the moment is on anti-Black racism, Black people are disproportionately represented throughout the criminal process, including as defendants in court. And that overrepresentation of Black people as defendants can be compared to an underrepresentation of Black people as judges, as barristers in particular. And that disparity can exacerbate the factors which impede participation, including feelings of exclusion and isolation and so on. It also creates potential for serious miscommunication. I don't want to make any sweeping generalizations, but I think it's fairly safe to assume that a lot of judges and barristers might not be well-versed in the ever-evolving slang of young people and language and phrases that are used by young Black people in particular, and which may feature as part of the evidence in a case. So I don't want to go on about this too much. I do want to pass on to our speakers, but I wanted to take the liberty as chair to note the context in which we are discussing this topic, both in terms of the anti-racist movement and the incentive that has given to consider in more depth systemic and institutional racism within the criminal justice system and the lockdown and what that means in terms of the administration of justice and participation in court. Okay, so that's enough from me. I want us to move on to today's speakers. I will briefly introduce our four excellent speakers who will be addressing various issues related to lay participation in court. We will first hear from Jody Blackstock, who is the legal director at Justice and a barrister by practice. As legal director, Jody is responsible for Justice's legal and policy output, aiming to strengthen the justice system across criminal, civil, and administrative jurisdictions. Many of you may know that Justice has produced a number of reports in recent years, which look at participation and communication in court, including the 2019 report, Understanding Courts, which is the title of Jody's talk. Understanding Courts, Are Lay Participants Effectively Participating? We will then move on to Rabir Cobain, who is a barrister at Doughty Street Chambers. His practice is almost exclusively in crime, including cases involving young and vulnerable individuals. So he has seen and sees the criminal process from start to finish on many occasions, and is therefore very well placed to share with us the realities of lay participation within the criminal process, which is the title of his talk. Our third speaker is Professor Penny Cooper, who is currently a visiting professor at Birkbeck. Penny co-founded and chairs the Advocates Gateway website, which I'm sure is familiar to some of you. She also, amongst many other accomplishments, created ground rules hearings and the English witness intermediary model, and has published widely on special measures and vulnerable witnesses. So today Penny will be talking specifically about the assistance which intermediaries give to lay participants in a talk titled Intermediaries and Communication Assistance, Drawing International Comparisons as the Profession Grows. And then last but certainly not least, we have Phil Bowen from Center for Justice Innovation. He is the director of the center, leading the work and overall strategy. The center has published numerous reports and briefing papers focusing on procedural justice and issues of participation and communication, very recently including a project on young people's voices on the youth courts, which is what Phil will be talking about today. His talk is titled Respect, Understanding, Helpfulness and Voice in Youth Courts in England and Wales. Just before I turn over, in terms of format, each speaker will talk for approximately 15 minutes. We will then open it up to Q&A. There are some instructions in the chat function, but basically, if you can type in any questions that you have, and you can do it as our speakers are talking, and if you wish to include your name and your affiliation, and if your question is addressed to someone in particular, if you could also please note that. Okay, without any further ado, let me hand over to Jody, who will be talking about understanding courts.
Thank you very much, Abhinav, and thank you for having me and for everyone who has joined us today to talk about this really important subject. As you said, I'm going to focus on a report that Justice prepared and published last year, but this report is informed by all of our work and the work that we've been doing for the last 60 years, which includes a 2017 report on mental health and fair trial, current work on the benefits system and decision making within that, racial disparity in the youth justice system, and work that is due to start in the next month on family courts. So these are issues which affect the whole of our justice system, and in particular groups within that justice system that can be more vulnerable to the processes that it creates. So I'm going to share my screen so you can see my slides. I've put a few of these together. There's not a lot on here because I think it's more helpful to not overload on slides generally, and I also find that I speak much longer if I have slides, so I've just dropped a few items on here for your information. All of our reports are available on our website, so you can find anything you'd like to know and follow up there. Just to then reiterate, Justice is an org. I'm going to have to close you down so I can actually read these. There we go. Justice was established in 1957, and we're a group of leading jurists, We're an all-party law reform and human rights organisation working to strengthen the justice system across all of its parts, administrative, civil and criminal. And we're a membership organisation, which is where our strength lies, because these members are students, professors of law, senior judiciary, legal practitioners, all the way across the spectrum, and of course people with lived experience of the system. It's those members coming together that enable us to speak with authority and generate practical recommendations for reform. The work that we do is to enable fair, accessible and efficient legal process in which the individual's rights are protected and for which our international reputation for upholding and promoting the rule of law is protected. So that's what we do, and as you can imagine, lay participation is therefore key to that. Our report, Understanding Courts, therefore concluded, or I should say had it, it's a focus that the legal system must place the lay user at its heart, and that that process must be shaped around their needs. And we sat with this working party, which was chaired by Sir Nicholas Blake, a High Court judge, former High Court judge, with people from across the spectrum of legal expertise. The work lasted a year. It focused across all the facets of the justice system, criminal, civil, administrative. It took evidence from a wide variety of experts in order to identify the issues of concern and then produce recommendations for reform. It's also worth flagging for you that in the next month we will be publishing a report called When Things Go Wrong, or possibly, I mean, that's the working title, it may not end up with that title, which relates to the process of inquest and inquiry. And much of that work will also draw on these recommendations, because the same things arise for bereaved people and survivors in that jurisdiction. So three strands of this work then were understanding the process, understanding legal process, how that legal system communicates with lay users, and ensuring that there is a consistency of support and reasonable adjustment for lay users across all facets of the justice system. The working party concluded that it is, and it's not surprising to say this, that it's a fundamental obligation of a democratic state to provide an effective system of justice, which allows for the resolution of disputes to all within the jurisdiction. Any such legal system may only claim to be effective and thereby legitimate if it is designed in a way which allows for the participation of lay people, whether they are a victim, witness, juror, defendant, or litigant, and indeed someone attending court to observe proceedings. A layperson must be able to understand the court processes and the language in questioning of the legal professionals working within it. Conversely, the court must understand the needs of lay users. Despite many attempts to simplify the process in an era where cuts to legal aid mean that many more people go unrepresented, studies continue to cast doubt on how our justice system is currently operating, and previous research by Justice and others has found a disconnection between professionals and lay users in court, with the at times chaotic nature of proceedings creating a culture that marginalises the public using our courts. And as such, this working party sought to expand upon that previous work and make recommendations which it hopes could improve understanding of the court process for lay users and could challenge courtroom culture that leads to user dissatisfaction, confusion and exclusion. So taking you through these features, I'm just going to pop up some quotes for each one, each of these three, and talk you through the findings under each of those headings. So for understanding the process, the working party concluded that lay users often go to a court or tribunal without a sufficient understanding of what they should expect from that process and what the process expects from them. Such uncertainty and lack of clarity is capable of inhibiting the effective participation of the lay user and can have an alienating effect on members of the public attending court. That's the case whether that person is represented or not. And I think that's crucial to remember, because as lawyers, we don't imagine our first port of call is to explain what going to court looks like and explain who will be in the room and what each of their roles is. I think we always expect that someone else has done that for us. So it's imperative, therefore, that Her Majesty's Courts and Tribunals Service should publish practical information on what to expect at a hearing or a trial that is clear, accessible, and easy to understand. That guidance should be made available in a variety of formats and must include explanations of the roles of legal professionals and the hearing room layout, as well as guidance on navigating the court building, the order of those proceedings, and the process of giving evidence. That isn't legal advice, it's procedural information, and it's something which everyone going to court deserves, but does not necessarily receive. Although the Working Party considered that our system should fundamentally remain adversarial in nature, effective participation of lay users must be facilitated as much as possible by the presiding judge in each hearing through their case management role. And they should conduct those proceedings with a clear, accessible decision on the outcome. That means written summary of any judgment that's given, or if it is already in writing, a clear summary at the outset of what the conclusion is. Quite often, research we heard was that people just didn't understand what had happened in their hearing. And for a lay individual without legal representation, that is critical to understand, because there's no one to explain it to you afterwards. Communication with lay users. Members of the public attending court can often feel baffled by the, at times, impenetrable language and convoluted legal jargon used by legal professionals during proceedings. It is therefore imperative that legal professionals should always be mindful of the need to communicate with lay users in a clear and unpretentious manner. The increased presence of litigants in person in recent years has made the need for this requirement all the more pressing. What do we mean by that? I think it's important to just catalogue some of the language that we use in court. And this is a process that others in conducting research have done, and that we, over the life of this working party and subsequently have done when going to court and observing. In terms of mode of address, judges and magistrates can be called all sorts of different things. And as a layperson, you may not know how to address the court. The easiest solution for that is just for each tribunal at the outset to say, you can refer to me as judge. Or perhaps even more informally, if it's appropriate, Mr. Jones, Miss Blackstock. The most odd thing, I think, for lay people when going through the justice system is the my learned friend for barristers and the more derogatory term my friend for a solicitor, who apparently is not as learned as a barrister in our cultural, historical labelling of each other. There's no need in justices' view to keep those terms. We can just refer to each other as the prosecutor, Mr. Smith, Mr. Jones, or the defence barrister. Language. Well, here's a sort of run through of some of the things that I mean when I'm talking about language. Legalese, which isn't necessarily vocabulary that people can access or that we necessarily need to use. Bearing in mind that these are proceedings in which there's an unrepresented person on the other side or a lay person in the room who isn't going to have these explained. Abuse of process, admissible evidence. One I heard in a bail hearing in a magistrate's court, this gentleman is not heavily anteceded. A arraign, authorities, bill of indictment, committal, conditional discharge, domicile, please enter your plea, an ex parte hearing, hearsay evidence, jurisdiction, you need leave of the court, this offence is triable either way, pursuant to statute, skeleton argument, a suspended sentence, strikeout, will you make an undertaking? All of these things will be baffling unless you are legally qualified. And a great example from an intermediary called Paula Beckham, who's very experienced and was there to assist a young person with learning difficulties, for whom the solicitor was aware and had asked for that intermediary and thought that they were adapting their language, told the client that the court was minded to adjourn the case so it may be relisted. She then simplified this to, they might stop today and get another date for the hearing. So all of that should illustrate that we need, as a profession, to reevaluate the language that we use when talking to lay people. And the working party recommended a judiciary-led consultation to evaluate the modes of address and commonly misunderstood terminology deployed in court. The findings of such a review should inform training for new and continuing practitioners in order to encourage lawyers and judges to communicate more effectively with court users, not least to put themselves in those lay people's shoes. Focusing on the questioning of witnesses, which Penny might pick up on later, this should always be fair and appropriate so that the witness has the opportunity to give accurate evidence. It isn't about trying to confuse or pick up or trip up a person in the witness box. It should be about enabling them to give their best evidence, whether you are examining in chief or cross-examining. So moving on then to the final aspect of this, consistency of support. Many people accessing our courts as parties or witnesses need additional support in order to take part, irrespective of how well informed they are by that process in advance or how well professionals communicate with them. It is crucial that the court process operates in a way which does not exclude such people from having proper access to our system. The working party therefore concluded that reasonable adjustments and support services currently made available to court users should be expanded across all jurisdictions, and good practice examples should be promoted. So just to recap, I've set out some here some of those recommendations for you that I've read out. There are 41 that go into some detail, practical detail about what needs to happen to enable cross-jurisdictional procedures that put lay people at the heart of legal process. In terms of what we've been doing since, I've listed here some aspects, and I'll just go through them quickly because we can perhaps pick some of these up in questions, and also I'm mindful of the time. But I think it is worth acknowledging some of the steps that have been taken, although we've got a long way to go. As a consequence of this report, HMCTS has drafted leaflets and posters in the criminal jurisdiction. So magistrates, courts and Crown Courts now have posters available that explain what happens in court and the role of the individuals there. The Crown Court compendium, which the Crown Court judges have available to them, has been updated to improve the information that's provided to defendants in person, and we're hoping that can be extracted out and produced as a separate leaflet, building on what's already been done. Easy read forms are now available for most elements of the criminal justice journey, and most recently criminal procedure rules have been updated, and I think these will come out in October, with explanations now to each rule in simple and accessible language, so that it's more easy to work through those rules if you're a lay person and attempt to grapple with them. Obviously, all of those things are the criminal jurisdiction. Most of that's because I sit on the Criminal Procedural Committee and I've had more sway in achieving that. But it felt like having some markers set down there were ones that we could then build on and take to the other rule committees to improve. What is absent so far? If you Google going to court, you'll see that there are updates on or improvements to the HMCTS website explaining what it's like if you're a victim or witness going to court. What we'd like to see is videos to go with that, that take you through the court building and explain what happens when you get there. And that's a work in progress that we're trying to improve. Sorry, I flipped over. We have sought that judiciary-led review of language in the court, and we're hoping to follow up on that shortly. The Intercourt College of Advocacy is now producing its own BPTC course. That will start, I think, in September, and that has been devised with these issues brought to bear because of its work around advocacy and the vulnerable and training for advocates, very much informed by Penny's work. That's also an element that we've been trying to promote with other providers and with the Bar Standards Board and Solicitors Regulation Authority about existing practitioners. The Civil Justice Council has picked up our report and has done quite a lot of work to promote this with its own consultation on vulnerability, for which we're really pleased. Support Through Court, which is the public support unit with a name that's perhaps more clear about what it does, is also getting some more support, financial support from government to assist people, and is now piloting a national telephone helpline to improve that support available to people ahead of court and on the day, which I think is generating positive results. Final point to make about the coronavirus, obviously this has shut our courts. We've been working very closely with HMCTS since March to identify how to get things moving in a digital way if that's necessary, and what that needs to look like, what guidance people need to be able to access a court remotely. So that's all building on everything that's gone before about what does court process look like. We have ourselves at Justice been piloting a fully virtual jury trial to see if we can get the Crown Court up and running so that people aren't languishing in custody and victims and witnesses are not left to unduly become anxious about how long it will take for their matters to be concluded. All of that's again on our website. I'd invite you to watch the videos of those proceedings. We produce an introduction to court video for that, which is shown to all jurors and witnesses ahead, to attempt to instill some clarity about what court process looks like, and on top of that, what a virtual court looks like. And we'll keep working with HMCTS to improve that. Final point to reference is, as a consequence of all of this work that we and others, particularly those on the call today, have been doing, is a vulnerability action plan, which HMCTS has just produced and is going to be working through now to ensure its reform programme is led by the needs of people, lay users using its system. What additional support do they need to be able to access online justice? And how can that actually influence face-to-face proceedings as well? So that's everything from me. I hope that was useful, and I'm happy to take questions at the end after everyone else's presentations. I now need to work out how to get you back so I can stop sharing my screen. Let's see. We're in a box at the moment that I can't expand very easily, so that's a bit annoying.
Is it at the top of the screen? Is there options?
That's the thing. There should be an open. I'm just going to drag it open until it appears, which hopefully it will in a minute.
I think I can do it for you. Let me see what happens.
That'd be great, I sort of lost everything. Wonderful. Yeah.
Okay, that's satisfactory. Okay,
I'm on it way to finish when I'm promoting how we've been telling people to use digital systems.
Thank you very much for that, Jordi. That was really informative and great to know the progress that has already been made on the back of that report and plans to go forward. Okay, I don't want to talk too much in between speakers, so I want to hand straight over to Rabah, who is going to talk about the realities of labour participation from his perspective as a barrister in crime.
Thank you. This is an important and engaging topic, and I'm grateful, Abhinav, to be invited to speak on the subject alongside such accomplished co-panelists. As Abhinav has mentioned, I'm a practicing barrister. I focus primarily on crime and crime-related public law. And this means I have seen the criminal justice process unfold numerous times from start to finish. That includes from the police station during some rare experiences, to first appearance at the magistrates' court, plea and trial preparation hearings in the Crown Court, to trial or sentence, or both. And so what I thought would be interesting to do in my presentation is to follow a defendant, the main lay participant, through this process, and at the same time track some aspects of their level of participation and barriers they may confront at each stage of that process. Now, it's not a mystery novel, so you won't have to wait until the end to find out the conclusion I propose to reach. And my conclusion is what emerges from this exercise is that defendants are often silenced and treated with unnatural suspicion, even though presumed innocent. And this can, and I would argue does, directly impact their capacity, willingness, and ability to participate effectively in proceedings. Now, given the time I have, I split this presentation into three broad stages, by no means intended to encapsulate the entirety of the criminal justice process. And I restrict myself to just a few points under each stage after a brief explanation of the purpose of that stage. So, first, police interview. This is a part of the criminal justice process where the investigation is still ongoing. It's intended to be the first opportunity for a suspect to formally provide their version of events in response to questions by the police. Often this will be after arrest, though it can also be by prior arrangement. Often the suspect will have a duty solicitor or a police station representative, although again, they may arrange their own solicitor. But if it is a duty solicitor or a police station rep, it's also usually someone they've never met before. It's also key, I think, to point out that to end up in a cell before interview or a cold room, and they often are cold, where the interview is conducted, the threshold is merely suspicion. So practically, and quite often, this can literally just be based on an allegation that's been made. The officer must simply have suspicion to arrest you and investigate further. So, 2 points about participation in this context. First, no comment interviews. More often than not, in my experience, suspects give a no comment interview. And usually this is because they've been advised to do so. This itself can be for any number of good, entirely innocent reasons. It's important to remember that this is a stage where both suspect and their solicitor will have received absolutely minimal disclosure. It can be quite literally a summary of 2 or 3 paragraphs without access to the underlying or source material. And I've seen some of these that items, paragraphs that solicitors receive, and it can be quite poor for someone who's about to have potentially the most important interview of their life, which if they remain silent during, can be used against them at a later stage. And so you'll be in the dark, and frequently during the interview, you're expected to answer questions which go beyond the basis of the disclosure received. So an officer does have the freedom to ask questions not based on the information that they've shown you, but information which has not necessarily been part of the initial disclosure given. So statements that haven't been referred to or alluded to. And sometimes poorly handled interviews end up with additional charges. So you go into an interview charged with common assault and you come out of a poor interview charged with about three extra counts that weren't, extra charges that weren't founded on the initial evidence. And that can be for all kinds of reasons. But solicitors are obviously trained, experienced professionals. And they're very conscious of this dynamic. And they're very conscious of the lack of information they are provided with. Solicitors are also conscious that the suspect to be interviewed has usually been held in a cell for hours. They've been woken at odd times of the night. They've been disconnected from their support network. And perhaps they've not had access to usual medication. Perhaps they've not had access to usual needs. And a quite minor point, but I think important, they've not been fed meals with regard to the nutritional value they have. So it's not uncommon to hear about police officers picking up Burger King or McDonald's on their way back to the custody suite. And that's kind of what you get to eat. And in this context, the suspect is expected to deliver a comprehensive, compelling, consistent account in a cold room with three strangers. So the situation, needless to say, is often far from ideal. And this means that when a suspect gives their account to a solicitor in private consultation, and there are inconsistencies within that account, which can potentially be quite innocently explained through tiredness, memory lapses, confusion, shock. Sometimes a no-comment interview is the best advice that the representative can give in those circumstances. And that's as opposed to feeding the investigation with what may or will be perceived as dishonesty within those inconsistencies and counted against the suspect. And so I say there may be good reasons for no comments, but the point I seek to draw from that is that at this stage already, a suspect, a lay participant, is silenced and their participation in the process is stifled. The second point related to this, but broader, is the conditions and the treatment received, which apply even to someone who does opt to give an account in an interview. Now, I'm not quite sure how many of us sitting in this conference have had the pleasure of being in a police station or a custody suite. Hopefully not many, hopefully no one. I have in a work capacity, and it's not the greatest part of the building. I've spoken about the cold, small rooms. There's uncomfortable beds you're just expected to put up with. There's a denial of contact with your support networks for what may be, I accept, perfectly legitimate investigative reasons, so to limit interference with the investigation. But it doesn't change the fact that there are restrictions on your liberty and there is a sheer lack of control and agency that you experience in that situation over literally everything. And unfortunately, an add-on is you're treated often by officers as though you're already guilty. And sure, they may have very good reasons in their mind for this. They may have just come out of interviewing an extremely vulnerable complainant and they've pretty much made up their minds. But this is still pre-charge, right? This is the suspicion stage. This isn't the reasonable prospect of conviction. This isn't conviction. This is a stage where the presumption of innocence, a framework we've created for the treatment of people at this specific stage of the process, is still in existence. But often despite that, as a suspect, you're treated like you've done whatever the allegation is. And even if you're not, even if you're treated well, your immediate environment is not really screaming for your innocence, right? You're in a custody suite and you're being told you can't call anyone. Your liberty is, in fact, already restricted to an extent you may have not experienced before. And the point I draw from that at this stage is that it's not entirely conducive to effective participation. When people are made to feel defensive, are poorly treated, are viewed with unrelenting suspicion, they don't tend to open up in the most accessible of ways. They don't tend to become forthcoming or cooperative, no matter what they have to say. And similarly, from an investigative point of view, if you've decided someone is guilty, you're less likely to treat their explanations in good faith. You're more likely to search for, even create, interpretations that bolster your own understanding of the case. And that approach by investigators informs reactions to it and also stifles participation. So that's the first stage. And right off the bat, two barriers to participation are socialized into the defendant's experience of the criminal justice process. A, silence is taught, and B, you're treated as though you're already convicted. And this kind of continues. It continues and snowballs throughout the process. The second stage, which I take briefly, pre-trial hearings. Now, these can range from first appearances to pre-trial preparation hearings where you're arraigned in the Crown Court, hearings about bail, case management hearings, and anything in between. And often, as a defendant, you say your personal details at the start. And the expectation is you only speak when spoken to. If you're self-representing, the same applies. So the process happens to you rather than with you. You have very, very limited input over what happens. Even dates to avoid are treated with a level of scrutiny. It's your date, it's your trial, but it's like, are you sure you can't make that one? Do you have evidence of that holiday? So it's a process that's happening to you. Again, you're presumed innocent at this stage, but walk into any courtroom with the big glass dock and the side glances, and it's difficult to envisage a first instinct reaction of, oh, maybe this is all a huge misunderstanding. And there's one point about participation in the context of this stage, which I draw attention to. And it's something you pick up as you become ingrained in the court culture. And it becomes very normalized for lawyers and judges and people who often frequent courts for research purposes or whatever it is. Speech by the defendant, and it's this, speech by the defendant is frequently viewed with suspicion. So anything is really preferred to come through the advocate most of the time. There's obviously exceptions. As with everything I say, there's exceptions. There are some judges who go out of their way and they're absolutely lovely and we know them by name to include the defendant. But most of the time, the process is happening to you. And even with those cases where there is an effort to actively involve you, if you try to contribute out of turn or out of order, or in a general way outside a prescribed subject matter, it's viewed as odd or suspicious. Why is he talking? What's the relevance of that? And it may be incredibly important to you as the defendant that you communicate this, but you're often just told to be quiet, despite this process being about you. So throughout this broadly framed second stage, there's a continuation of this approach where you're treated like you're suspicious or tainted, and effectively you're silenced unless you're extremely conformist to the approach expected of you or to the behaviors expected of you. So that's the second stage. The third broad stage I come to is the trial stage. And ironically, the trial stage is often where we actually start to talk about effective participation. So when you look at the Article 6 case law within the convention, most of it, so Stanford, other cases, most of them are about your ability to effectively participate during the trial process, give instructions, examine witnesses against you, and so on and so forth. And much of the case law on fitness to plead and so on is similarly about that. Although some relate to pre-trial issues, but the bulk is, can this person participate in their trial? However, as I hope you'll have seen from my kind of quick stage browse, the defendant's socializing experiences into the criminal justice and courtroom process has already happened through the multiplicity of pre-trial hearings and experiences they've had before the trial starts. And what have they learned so far? Be quiet, and most people already think you're guilty. In terms of the trial process, before I come to the points about participation under this stage, most of us will kind of know this already, so I won't spend too much time on it. But briefly, it's a prosecution opening speech to start. The prosecution call their evidence, witnesses, exhibits, whatever else it may be, produce those in front of the jury or the court. The defense will have the opportunity to test that evidence through cross-examination. There may be legal arguments along the way on the admissibility of evidence, and then the defense have their turn effectively, usually with the bulk of the evidence coming from the defendant if they choose to give evidence. And they don't have to give evidence. It's not infrequent that they choose not to give evidence. 2 points, and then there's obviously closing speeches, directions, summing ups, and a verdict. 2 points on participation in this respect. First, this is, and even if we become normalized to it, it really is a broadly artificial experience for the defendant. For example, they are discouraged from reacting to evidence or decisions they perceive as unjust or untruthful. And if you're pleading not guilty, if you're entering a not guilty plea and having a trial, presumably you're saying what the prosecution has to offer is, or much of what the prosecution has to offer is untrue, misunderstood, or somehow inaccurate. But despite this, you're discouraged from adverse body language or speaking up or looking at the jury sometimes or communicating with anyone, the prison guards who sit at the back. In a long trial, sometimes they become the defendant's best friend. So you're just discouraged from communicating in various ways. You sit in the dock in silence and the process kind of just happens. What I point to in this respect is we create a culture or atmosphere in the courtroom which tells the observer that any of the ordinarily human and quite natural reactions that one may have in real life, such as becoming upset or having physical reactions to something that's said or done, or even becoming angry, these things, we create a culture or atmosphere that says these are not human or natural, but they're indicative of volatility, aggression, even guilt. And there is an immense pressure of self-censorship on the defendant, or at least a defendant who is trying their best and following the culture created. And this is reinforced by everyone, including your own lawyers. And as lawyers, we always want what's best for our clients at every juncture. And so we will tell our clients to remain calm, to not react. We will have heated conferences where they are upset, crying, distressed, having a literal breakdown in a cell beneath the courtroom, but they have to clean it all up, walk back into court behind a glass box, and pretend they have no feelings most of the time. And this is because we as lawyers are equally conscious that the spotlight is on our clients. They're being scrutinized for their every move by the judge if it comes to sentence eventually, by the jury, who we don't know what they're thinking, by prosecutors who may take slights or perceive certain actions in one way or another. And ironically, doing your best, and we want our clients to do their best, means doing nothing. Apparently. So when we speak about effective participation, this artificiality which stifles basic expression can A, be a significant impediment to how free the defendant feels to actually participate, and B, affect how much a defendant trusts a process which doesn't even allow them to be themselves. And this brings me to my final point within this range of stages, but also overall. After all of these experiences and this kind of conveyor belt of insecurities that a defendant is brought through, they're expected to stand up, walk into a box, witness box, not a literal box, and give what can be the most important evidence of their lives. So after they have been told from day one what they can and can't say, been treated with guilt and suspicion, they're then expected to up and fully participate, effectively be open, confident, and consistent. It can be confusing, overwhelming and expectations are always conflicting. This is inadmissible. Don't say this. Don't go near this. This isn't, I don't think this is the best approach. And even whilst they're giving their evidence, they must themselves navigate rules of evidence. If a client has previous convictions, they're not allowed to say anything positive about themselves. Well, technically they should be allowed to, but God forbid if they do, there's an application all of a sudden to bring everything bad they've done before. So they, whilst they're giving the evidence, they are restricted in what they can and can't say. So for example, I had a case where my client said they helped his aunt do the dishes and there was a bad character application brought to bring in his previous convictions because it may have given the jury a false impression about his character. The offence had nothing to do with washing or not washing dishes. So ironically, with all of this, the way we interact, much of whether we trust what someone is saying, not exclusively, but I think significantly, comes from the confidence in the way it's said. And we interpret, we tend to interpret a lack of confidence as doubt or maybe dishonesty or some kind of uncertainty. And yet it's this defendant who's expected to be extremely confident, having gone through all of that, when they give their evidence, when they participate. It's difficult. So in conclusion, and then I will stop talking, the fact a defendant is perceived a certain way or feel they are perceived a certain way can have an impact on their capacity to participate effectively. And the reason perceptions, I would argue, or one of the reasons such perceptions exist, goes back to how we speak about crime and criminal justice in public, media, and political discourse. We other and dehumanize offenders, and implicitly those accused of offenses. We do not sufficiently invest in infrastructure where offenders or those accused of offending are expected to exist. So prisons, docks, custody suites in police stations, cells in court buildings, they are physically unattractive places. The physical spaces we're expecting them to be present in scream of guilt, otherness, and dehumanization. And this all contributes to perception by others and self-perception by the defendant themselves. And likewise, these are all barriers to trust. Trust that as a defendant, I can speak freely. Trust that as a defendant, I am viewed as innocent until proven guilty. Trust that this is an environment where I can express myself freely and have the opportunity to be believed. And barriers to trust are barriers to participation. And to loosely quote Leslie Thomas, Queen's Counsel, a lack of participation by the critical participant is not good enough. That's my experience. I know it's more of an essay or argument, but I hope it gives an overview of kind of defendants' experiences, at least practically through the process. And I'm happy to take questions as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rava. Oh, that was a really enlightening account of your experience. And I think you raised a lot of important points and food for thought, especially for me thinking about the effects of what happens before the trial on participation at the trial itself. I think that's a really important point. Okay, we turn swiftly then from the participation of defendants to intermediaries and communication assistants who are sometimes available to assist said defendants. So I'll hand over to Penny.
Thank you very much, Abner, and thank you, LSE. And thank you for everyone who's joined, not only from England and Wales, but from other jurisdictions as well, particularly those for whom this time of day is perhaps not the most convenient. You've gone above and beyond if you've joined us, for example, from down under, and I know some people have, so thank you for that. I'm just going to share my screen. I've got a few slides. Which, can you all see those now? Have those slides come up? Yeah, great, thanks for the thumbs up, Abner. I'm going to go through these slides. There's only about 9 of them. I'll take it at quite a fast pace. They'll be available afterwards. And there are some references to an article which has got the hyperlink in it for it. And at the very end, to a book which will be free to download, all about participation. It's coming out in September. And most of what I'm going to talk about in these slides actually comes from one of my chapters, or my chapter rather, in that book. Details, as I say, at the end. So this is a talk about intermediaries, and I want to start off with a definition for those who aren't familiar. Probably most people are, but in its most basic form, well, if you looked in a dictionary, you'd find out that an intermediary is a mediator or an agent between parties. But in the context of the justice system, we're talking about someone who helps convey questions to and answers from a witness. In England and Wales, there's a slightly more detailed definition of the intermediary in section 29 of the Youth Justice and Criminal Evidence Act. But it's right to say that the role takes a variety of forms. Although there is a particular type of intermediary in England and Wales, some intermediaries operating in other jurisdictions work in a different way. So an intermediary could relay questions, they could conduct the questioning themselves, they could help others to plan their communication and only step in if questioning breaks down, which is the normal way, that last way for England and Wales. So eligibility in England and Wales, it's in the legislation, section 16, but we must talk about the accused, and I'm going to come to that in about three slides time in more detail. Because the legislation, which was put in place in 2011 so that there could be an intermediary for the accused when they give evidence, is not yet in force. So judges are still relying on their inherent jurisdiction to direct an intermediary, I should say, if one is required for a fair trial for the defendant. The profession is growing. And when I talk about the profession here, I'm talking about the profession that is the model used in England and Wales. There are, as I've said, other types of intermediary available around the globe, but in England and Wales, the model that developed, where the intermediary assesses the person who needs communication assistance, they assess their communication needs and abilities, and then advises the communicator and steps in only if required. That version has been adopted in Northern Ireland, three states in Australia, as well as New Zealand. Each is different, slightly different ways in which they've been implemented, and they fit in obviously in a different context in those jurisdictions because they have to fit in with the existing justice system. But I should also say that intermediaries from England and Wales have been used in a number of other jurisdictions. Some that come to mind are the Republic of Ireland, the Channel Islands, the Caribbean, etc. So whilst they may not have formal schemes, they have used intermediaries from England and Wales to help with communication with someone who is deemed vulnerable. Vulnerability, here I'm talking about someone who is either under 18 or due to physical or mental incapacity. Needs support. That's how we define vulnerability in the criminal justice system in England and Wales. But I have to recognise, of course, vulnerability is much wider than that, and there are many different definitions. So having taken years, actually, to spread this idea of the English model of intermediaries, I took stock when I was writing a chapter recently and compared that with other special measures, and actually concluded, perhaps rather disappointingly, that intermediaries, as well as other special measures, are under-researched in terms of their effectiveness. It's rarely the subject of academic study, and it's often that's the sort of thing that you need to push along the policymakers to increase the uptake at a policy level of this idea of using intermediaries. They're niche as well, in that they are applied to those deemed vulnerable and kept, you know, within those boundaries as a model of assistance. Although one likes to think that their educative effect goes wider than the instance where they assisted, one hopes that advocates and judges, and I think it's true that they do, but have learned from cases where they've had an intermediary involved and reflected on and improved their communication more generally. The other thing to say is that intermediaries are temporary fixes for that particular case. So although I've just said one hopes that judges and advocates and other practitioners as well learn from intermediaries, the fact of the matter is the traditional mores of court culture, the things that we've heard talked about already, they are incredibly difficult to shift, and they carry on. They remain unchanged for the most part, notwithstanding the impact of intermediaries. Overall, it's probably ground rules hearings that have had a bigger impact because they're of wider application. And the origin of ground rules hearings, you can read about in, I've embedded the link in the slides, in an article I wrote with Paula Bakken and Ruth Marchant that was published in the Criminal Law Review in 2015. I noticed that Paula is actually joining us today. We wrote that with the late and wonderful Ruth Marchant. Ground rules hearings are essentially a way to have a discussion between the judge, the intermediary if there is one, and the advocates to decide how to set the correct parameters for good communication, whether that's timing, including breaks, for example, whether that's the tone that's used, the type of questions, etc. Many more things as well. And on the Advocates Gateway, there's a ground rules hearings toolkit. You can see the sorts of things that are covered in a ground rules hearing. Ground rules hearings, although they started in England and Wales because intermediaries found they needed to have them, and Abner, you very kindly credited me with creating ground rules hearings, which I can say yes, okay, I came up with the idea, but it was intermediaries who actually put them into practice. They made them a thing in practice because I said, please go ahead and do your very best to get in front of the judge with the advocates and have discussions about the do's and don'ts for the upcoming witness when you before you actually conduct your role, because not having that beforehand was actually quite a challenge, a huge challenge in fact for the early intermediaries. But we're getting behind really in England and Wales, because if you compare what's happening in other jurisdictions overseas with ground rules hearings, who thought, well, this is a good idea to have this discussion and set the parameters, and the judge is much more in control when that happens, they put them in legislation in three other jurisdictions. We've had them in rules since 2014. We've adopted them in the family justice system in a practice direction, not rules. But Victoria and Australian Capital Territory and even Scotland as well have managed to get ground rules hearings into legislation, which is very impressive. But I want to go back to intermediaries and defendants. And as I've said already, we're still in this position, I think, which has started to make England and Wales look increasingly behind the times. We're still in this position where judges are using their inherent jurisdiction as opposed to having any legislation to fall back on around the appointment of an intermediary for a defendant, either for the whole trial or for when they give evidence, if they give evidence. We all, I think, those of us who follow this area of practice closely, took a bit of a sharp intake of breath in 2016 when there were the amendments brought out, the criminal practice directions in April. They came out twice a year, and the April amendments in 2016 said that directions to appoint an intermediary for a defendant's evidence will thus be rare for the entire trial, extremely rare. And if that wasn't concerning enough, they soon got confirmed in the case of Rashid by the Lord Chief Justice. And although I'm not aware of any particular research that would tell us this for sure, the impression is that that wording in the criminal practice direction, the confirmation in Rashid, acted as downward pressure on the number of appointments of intermediaries for defendants. So that's what I think overall, that's the impression, and intermediaries may have other views. But the president of the Queen's Bench Division, we can all let out a sigh of relief, address that point, because the district judge in TI, district judge in the Bromley Youth Court, amongst other things in her reasons, had relied on this, appointments will be rare, for the entire trial, extremely rare, practice direction to Anne Rashid and Grant Murray, which came afterwards, to refuse the application for an intermediary for TI. The president of the QBD on this judicial review of that decision said, well, most cases will involve defendants who don't require the assistance of an intermediary. Therefore, the appointment of an intermediary will be rare. It doesn't follow that there is a high hurdle to overcome for the appointment of an intermediary if one is necessary for the effective participation of a defendant in the trial. So it took away that, what we can say now is a misperception that the criminal practice directions of 2016 raised the bar or the hurdle for the appointment of an intermediary. So now we have to see whether or not that case of TI will actually make a difference in practice. The point that was made overall, which obviously it needed to be said, but it seems very obvious, that the defendant needs a fair trial, and you take each case as it comes, look at each defendant and see what they need. Do they need an intermediary? What I think is even more, if anything, interesting about this case is that counsel for Just for Kids Law, who's bringing this challenge on behalf of TI, said, or made the point, as had been made in Grant Murray, that the general consensus is that the measures currently deployed are simply not good enough to ensure effective participation. And she relied on the Law Commission report and the review of the justice system in England and Wales by Charlie Taylor, and said, notwithstanding the adjustments made to facilitate a child's participation, the general consensus is they're not good enough. The court rejected the invitation to provide a judicial view on the so-called general consensus, because it can only apply the law as it is. And that is true. So where do we go from here? Well, it comes back to the policymakers, doesn't it? And then Parliament, if it so wishes. Because absolutely, the judges can only apply the law as it is and interpret it. What is the general consensus then? Because it could be argued, and it was mentioned by the president of the QBD in that TI case, that things have moved on. There are, for example, there is a requirement for compulsory training for those who appear in the youth court. I would say, however, and this wasn't a point argued in the case, it wasn't part of the concerns, but overall I would have thought the general consensus is that things are more worrying since COVID-19 has accelerated this move towards virtual hearings. If you look at a very recent EHRC report, the findings and recommendations, it said that almost all the criminal justice professionals in England and Wales who were interviewed felt that the use of video hearings doesn't enable defendants or accused people to participate effectively and reduces opportunities to identify if they have a cognitive impairment, mental health condition, and or neurodiverse condition. So what you've got now is, I think, new challenges overlaid onto the old problems, the arcane language, the lack of representation, etc., things that we have heard about already and have been written about and researched for many years. So that takes us up to the present day and the research that I've done, things I've written about. But what I intend to be writing about quite soon, i.e. in the next few months, is the assessment of witnesses remotely. Intermediaries need to assess someone's communication needs and abilities. They have been doing it for quite a while now in New South Wales because of the geographic constraints, meaning that you can't move witnesses and or intermediaries easily to be in the same place face to face for an assessment of their communication needs and abilities before court. So there's a history there, but COVID-19 has meant that there have been intermediaries also in England and Wales conducting remote assessments, i.e. attempting to do what they'd normally do face-to-face over Skype or some other platform. In conclusion, participation, I think, not digitization, has to be the watchword for moving forward. And it worries me that we had a big swing and acceleration towards digitization without the necessary foundations of research on participation. And it's essentially one of the points that I make in the final chapter, looking ahead in this book. Now, I know it says £32, the bargain of £32 if you pre-order it. But wait for it to come out in September as an e-publication, because the funders, Nuffield Foundation, who funded the research behind this book, have also funded an e-publication which will be free to download for everybody. And that is a book which writes about what practitioners, the people who work in the courts, think participation entails and what its functions are. We interviewed over 150 practitioners. We had over 300 hours of court and tribunal observations. So I did that work with Jessica Jacobson, Amy Kirby, Gillian Hunter, and others. Four of us have written that book. So you'll get to see what participation entails from the practitioner's point of view based on our research. And without, this isn't a, no spoiler here, something you could probably guess, participation means lots of different things to different people. And the policymakers talk about it a lot, but don't define what it is. And as good as I believe our research has been, we also need research on participation with court users, and indeed an international approach. Most of my work since 2015 with intermediaries has been in other jurisdictions, helping those jurisdictions set up schemes. And we have a lot to learn from each other. And I shall stop there.
Thank you very much, Penny. That was a really useful update for me anyway on where we're at with intermediaries, especially the most recent case in relation to defendant intermediaries. I'm very much looking forward to the publication of the book. From what I've seen of it so far, it's going to be really useful. So we will move from intermediaries to the youth courts and hear from Phil, who will be talking. The title of Phil's talk, Respect, Understanding, Helpfulness and Voice in the Youth Courts in England and Wales.
Okay. Thank you very much to Abena and to the LSE for the invite. I'm aware that as a kind of 40-year-old middle-class white man, I'm maybe not the perfect person to try to summarise and represent the experiences of 10 to 17-year-olds in our youth courts, but what I thought I'd do is start with a couple of quotes that we gathered from our interviews with children and young people who had attended youth courts in the past 18 months. I didn't have a clue. It just happened. Nobody was explaining what was going on. When do I get my chance to speak? You shouldn't have to sit in a box when you're innocent. I want to set the context for those comments first by setting out what a youth court ought to be, and then talking about some of the facts and figures about both youth court hearings themselves and the environment they sit in. So for those of you who don't know, youth courts should have substantial adjustments already compared to our adult criminal courts. They're intended to make them more suitable for young people. These should include judges and magistrates who sit in youth courts should have specialised training. Lawyers who appear should have competencies to work in youth court. These courts themselves are closed to members of the public and have reporting restrictions. They ought to, where possible, have less formal courtroom layouts that allow parties to be on the same level, and where young people are should sit outside the dock and be close to their parents and supporters. And around that is obviously the youth offending services that play an important role in both informing decision making by the courts and then overseeing court orders. Those teams are themselves multi-agency teams, comprising ideally of police officers, probation officers, social workers, health workers, education workers, as well as youth offending service officers. So that's what our youth courts ought to be like. So just some facts and figures. So over the past 10 years, there's been a 76% reduction in proven offences by young people. That has had a knock-on consequence for the number of kids who are actually coming into our youth courts. So we've seen again that's about a 75% reduction in the number of kids coming to court. There are a number of reasons for that. Part of it is there's been a greater use of pre-court disposals and out-of-court diversion to divert young people away from prosecution. But also there has been just a fall in crime level more generally amongst young people. But what that's meant is that the young people who do remain in the system and who are appearing at our youth courts tend to be the most vulnerable. They often have significant welfare and other needs, as well as more serious offending profiles. So looked after children, Black, Asian and minority ethnic children and young people in particular, are well overrepresented in our youth justice system. Factors that are commonly reported in the background of the young people who come to our courts include economic deprivation, low educational attainment, and experiences of abuse and neglect. Additionally, we found data that suggests there's a high incidence of mental health problems and learning difficulties and disabilities, including challenges with speech and language. Significant numbers of the young people coming to court are defined as being persistently absent or excluded from mainstream education. In addition to that, the environment in which youth courts operate has also changed in the past decade. In particular, the youth court and associated agencies have been subject to significant pressures over the last decade. Most notably, more than half of all our magistrates' courts in which youth courts are normally housed have closed since 2010. Further, evidence from the Local Government Association has highlighted significant reductions in funding for youth and children's services and youth offending services. So, for example, the figure suggests that youth justice grants, which fund youth offending services, have decreased from £145 million in 2010-11 to only £71,000 last year. And the Local Government Association has reported that local authorities are now having to cover the shortfall in their budgets, because the multiple and complex needs of those children remaining in the justice system require considerable support beyond what the current funding provides. So in response to that shrinking caseload and changing cohort appearing in our youth courts, my organisation, the Centre for Justice Innovation and the Institute for Crime and Justice Policy Research at Birkbeck, embarked on a multi-year research project examining existing youth court practice. And central to that research and the resulting main report, which will be available in a couple of weeks, were conversations with young people in 2019 about their perceptions of youth courts. Much of what they told us related to ideas around procedural fairness. The idea that the importance of feeling fairly treated, it determines future trust in and compliance with the law. And we know from the research that procedural fairness is driven by four factors. Firstly, understanding the court process, having a voice in proceedings, being treated with respect, and being able to trust the neutrality of the decisions made. And so our forthcoming report on the Youth Court, Time to Get It Right, which will be made public on the 30th of June, highlights the experiences of young people in their own words. The young people we interviewed had a variable but largely limited understanding of the court process. For example, it just happened. Nobody was explaining what was going on to me. Many did not know what to expect before they attended court, were unable to follow the proceedings, and many left leaving the courtroom still unsure of what had happened and why. As one young person said, I don't even know what my sentence is. While some young people that we interviewed felt heard in youth court, a common frustration was a lack of voice in proceedings. I didn't even think I could slip a word in edgeways, said one. So even where the opportunity to engage did exist, the atmosphere and layout of courts could often render young people unwilling or unable to engage. Some young people that we interviewed did feel that the court process treated them with respect, but others noted that simple opportunities to communicate respectfully were not met. As one young person said, it would have made you feel a lot better if they could just introduce themselves. Worse still, a few felt openly disrespected by professionals' perceived belittling of their language and behaviour, as well as some people being frustrated by the requirements such as sitting in the dock. As I said before, one young person said, I don't see why you should have to sit in a box if you're innocent. Moreover, several young people that we interviewed, far from seeing the youth court as a benevolent and unbiased institution, felt the whole process was just setting them up to fail. They're there to sentence you, not to think that you're innocent. Another young person said, there's a lot of politics going on in the court, and often we don't know what's going on. Our research into young people's experience of court was married with some research that we did in 2016, where we spoke to young adults between the ages of 18 to 25 who'd had recent experience of attending magistrates' courts, and we learnt about their experiences. And there was no doubt from our interviews that young adults wanted and needed to understand what was happening to them when they attended court. Yet almost all of those we spoke to, including those who attended repeatedly, reported difficulties at some, if not all, stages of what can be a confusing and a very technical process. We heard many young people report not being sure what to expect before they turned up, not being able to follow proceedings as they happened, and people who, again, left court not knowing what had actually gone on and what sentence they'd received. In all our conversations with young adults about their experiences at magistrates' courts, the issue that came up consistently and which most animated them was frustration at not feeling their voices had been heard adequately. Comments such as, they don't talk to you, they just talk about you, were commonplace in our discussions and suggest that those young people we spoke to were not at all satisfied that the court process had been fair to them. So I guess what those two bits of research that we've done suggest, and they fit into a much wider body of research around procedural fairness in our courts, what they all suggest is that physical court hearings are far from perfect at the moment, as we've already heard. And in our forthcoming research report, we make specific recommendations about what can be done to improve young people's participation in court. As I said, we'd found that much more could be done to improve the procedural fairness and specialisation of youth court hearings, specifically improving the court layout and the communication skills of magistrates to encourage engagement between children and the young people and the bench. So, for example, we will recommend that Her Majesty's Court and Tribunal Service sets a goal that all youth court cases should be heard in adapted courtrooms by the end of this parliament. We've also recommended that the Judicial College develops a suite of training resources for youth court magistrates, including video guides for good engagement practice. And finally, we've recommended that senior judiciary set a clear expectation that youth court magistrates and judges engage in continuous monitored professional development about their skills around engagement. We also looked at another aspect of youth courts, that is the idea of review hearings. It was a key recommendation of three previous reviews into the youth justice system, the Carlisle Review, the Taylor Review, and most recently the Lammy Review. All of them have recommended that there should be a process created whereby the court regularly engages and reviews post-sentence children and young people and asks them how their community sentences are progressing and discusses with them how they can be better engaged in those processes. And in our research, while there's been no nationwide adoption of any of those recommendations by government, we did find some areas using informal magistrate-led review hearings for young people. We therefore, in our research report, recommend that the Youth Justice Board extends the use of these reviews to more pilot sites and assesses their impact through an independent evaluation of the pilot projects. And finally, we recommend that the Ministry of Justice and the Court Service and Senior Judiciary identify and resource a single government body to take overall responsibility for identifying, sharing and promoting innovative and better practice in youth courts, because we far too often found that the Ministry and the Court Service and Senior Judiciary would all blame each other for why our youth courts were not fit for the purpose. In thinking about these remarks, I obviously have been thinking a lot about the use of remote hearings due to COVID. And obviously that adds an additional dimension to the challenges that we've identified. In his appearance before the Justice Select Committee, the Lord Chief Justice said, it appears that England and Wales is quite a long way ahead of the game. Proponents of remote hearings like Professor Richard Susskind are leading the charge for more virtual and online courts, convinced that enforced ramping up of remote video hearings due to COVID-19 shows that virtual courts work. For them, this crisis has been useful in forcing courts to adopt the technology in a way that was likely to otherwise be slow and incremental. Yet it's hard to gauge whether the Lord Chief and Professor Susskind's assessments are actually correct. It's hard to make qualitative comparisons between jurisdictions. It would appear, for example, that the English and Welsh court system do have the technology to enable them to restart Crown Court jury trials, which some other jurisdictions have not been able to do and will not be able to do for some while yet. But the ability to make that acceleration towards more remote hearings does raise concerns, as we've already heard, about effective engagement and participation. There are, of course, concerns from lawyers who may accept that this technology is coming, but who are concerned about how it applies to their area of law. A family law barrister, Lucy Reed, has recently written, how can we really claim victory over other jurisdictions if our remote hearings mean that a parent is too distraught or confused to be able to follow what is happening in an emergency family justice hearing, which results in their baby being taken away? And indeed, the work that we've been involved in with the Nuffield Family Justice Observatory shows that the use of remote hearings in family courts during the crisis shows a distinctly mixed picture, including some admittedly good practice, but also some very worrying features. Moreover, there's been a recent rapid review of cases in the civil courts and remote hearings in the civil courts that suggests that the majority of respondents felt that remote hearings were worse than hearings in person overall and much less effective in terms of facilitating participation. And while it's true that this research has also pointed to many advantages of remote hearings, the picture generally shows that these types of remote hearings can be fine for professionals when speaking professional to professional, but are deeply problematic at the moment for citizens. In the criminal courts, there is already evidence which suggests that remote appearances may have a negative impact on outcomes, especially in the use of custody. Penny's already mentioned the EHRC report, which further suggests complications around remote hearings. As yet, there's been no independent study of remote hearings in criminal courts during the COVID-19 crisis, and certainly only anecdotal insights into youth court hearings. Nonetheless, I am optimistic because I think this flurry of research has already raised some central questions about justice in remote hearings. Many of the issues that it's raised were already present before COVID-19, but have been given a sharper edge. We need to have a proper public debate about some basic justice questions. For example, there remains an absolute need to establish on what basis remote hearings ought to be used in the future. Who gets to decide whether they're used in each case? Is it the court service itself? Is it government accountants? Is it the judge? Is it lawyers? Or actually, is it the actual citizen themselves? Should remote hearings always have an equality of arms where they only proceed if everyone appears remotely? Or should we continue to allow video hearings where some are physically gathered and others are only beamed in? And if so, in which cases? Other questions that are raised are, what is the role and voice of the victim in these matters? It's not just a matter, for example, that some vulnerable victims may prefer to participate virtually. What weight do we give to the victim in deciding whether a remote trial is the sort of justice that they want to see? We did some work back in 2018 on public attitudes to court hearings and video hearings, which suggested that the public were very comfortable with the use of video hearings in criminal matters, but only for very low-level offences. But as soon as the issues that we put to them were seen as serious, they expected physical court hearings to convey the seriousness and solemnity that society should attach to such matters. All of this suggests that we need an extensive public and parliamentary debate about some of these fundamental principles. It's clear courts are moving, whether we like it or not, to greater remote hearings. The Lord Chief Justice himself told Parliament on May 13th that there will be no going back to how courts used to run pre-COVID. It's therefore, in my view, even more vital that before those COVID-19 ways of working are made the new normal, that there is a clear public debate with lawmakers and the wider public about when remote and online justice is appropriate and when it is not. The pandemic may have already given us a glimpse of what courts could look like, but that does not mean necessarily that that is what they ought to look like. These normative questions are fundamental justice questions. In the rush to respond to COVID-19, court officials and the judiciary have done a really admirable job in solving capacity and capability issues. But to truly tell if we are ahead of the game, as the Lord Chief Justice says, it is clear to me that these justice questions need an answer. I'm very happy to take questions.
Thank you very much. So we will, there's already some questions I've seen in the chat, so we will come on to those. I mean, I think that was a really great and concerning account of the experiences of young people in courts. So I do recall reading the report where the young defendant said, they don't talk to you, they talk about you. And I think it ties into things that Ravel was picking up on earlier as well, and raising some really important questions there about virtual hearings. One thing that sort of struck me across all of the presentations is that progress has been made in facilitating participation, and it is clearly on certain people's minds anyway. But we do still have a long way to go to ensure effective or meaningful participation for complainants, witnesses, and defendants. And a lot of what's being proposed are very simple, straightforward changes. And so there's a big question as to if it's potentially that easy, why? Why are we still in this position where this kind of archaic or legal language is being used and there continue to be these barriers to participation? I'm not going to ask you to answer that question, but that's what struck me. I'd rather you answered some of the questions that are come up in the chat. So I'm going to scroll back a bit to the question. Bear with me for a second because this is my first time doing Q&A on Zoom. But there were some excellent questions here. So we had a question. We had a couple of statements. I don't know if anyone would like to reflect on. So Miranda Bevan, who's a visiting fellow with us at the LSE, noted during Rabba's talk that many suspects are unrepresented in the police station and therefore don't have any disclosure, which will make the situation obviously worse for them. Another comment from Sandra Breton during your talk that it's a theatre, quite simply. I don't know if you want to comment on that. Does the process feel very theatrical to you, especially the in court?
Is that me? I think it's me. I don't know. I don't know if I'm best placed to answer that because I've kind of been socialized into it. So it's very normal to me now. Even putting on the wig and gown, it would just feel weird to not be in court without the wig and gown. And also it would feel that even over virtual hearings, we're not expected to wear wigs or gowns. So it feels odd to appear in court like that. So I don't know if I'm the best person to answer that. Maybe one of the other speakers can comment on whether it looks theatrical. Passing the buck.
Maybe I could join in here, having been on both sides of it as a practitioner and now sort of observing from the sidelines. There is ritual which will make it seem theatrical, but I don't think it's in any way near as theatrical as the US system is. There, I think, has been an awful lot of progress in the way we advocate cases as barristers to dampen down that sort of theatrical performance. But I don't think it's in any way gone. There's certainly a lot of members of the bar who think it's, you know, doing litigation or doing advocacy over a call like this is diminishing the ability to orate, which illustrates the fact that they think it should be more theatrical. But I think, yeah, the ritual of it can make it certainly seem like theatre. And to the lay people who are taking part in it, I imagine they feel like they are participants in a play without any lines.
I mean, I imagine the statement here that it is a theatre, quite simply, is probably an accurate reflection of at least how some lay people will see the process. While we're with you, Rabba, because there's another question just underneath it from Lucy Welsh at the University of Sussex, asking whether you think there are any differences between the ability of defendants to participate in trials in the magistrate's court as compared to Crown Court trials. And I don't know if Phil might want to jump in on that also in thinking about comparisons, any specific issues of the youth court in comparison to magistrates and Crown Courts. Oh, Rabba, you're on mute.
Sorry, I'm not on mute now. It's an interesting and very, very good question. I would have to kind of to think about it to give a proper comprehensive answer. I think there are kind of things about the magistrate's court which makes it easier for defendants to participate. And there are things about the Crown Court which make it easier for the defendant to participate or at least feel like they can participate, to pick just a couple or one or two. And then there's stuff that swings the other way. So in the magistrate's court, for example, it's far more, compared to the Crown Court, it's far more informal. Certainly in the youth court, it's more informal. People aren't in wigs and gowns. There are people kind of walking in and out. Practitioners often call it the Wild West. Things are just kind of happening all the time. It's a bit of a it's a bit chaotic. And I guess that chaos and the fact that things feel a bit more human is in a way familiar and can allow people to participate. So you'd have people shouting from the dock far more often in the magistrate's court than you do in the Crown Court. Maybe that has something to do with the seriousness of the offences, but it's certainly more informal in the magistrate's court compared to the Crown Court, and that can be an impetus for someone to participate more effectively, or maybe not. The Crown Court, I think, in my experience, defendants participate more effectively because they feel, and again, this is just from my experience and experiences of colleagues and people I've spoken to, and it's mainly because there is a jury rather than three people who they may not relate to at all, or two people who they may not relate to at all, or a judge sitting alone. They feel like the process is going to be fairer, and they feel like their input into the process will yield fairer results. So clients who are going to have a jury trial feel like if they give it their best, and they do try their best, and they participate effectively, give you full instructions, deal with all the evidence, then the jury will retire and will treat them as a peer, or at least they're more likely to treat them as a peer, which is obviously an interesting comment I make in light of the recent proposals to do away with jury trials. But I certainly feel like that part of the Crown Court has always been something that motivates defendants, in my experience, to participate and engage with the process. I hope that answers the question. Probably not, but that's all you're getting from me.
Yeah, I mean, it just sort of coming in on the kind of youth, I mean, I'm sure it is the case, certainly the comparison between adult magistrate court and youth court, I think it's certainly the case that on balance, young people have more opportunities to engage than the 18 to 25-year-olds we found in adult court, partly because even though we did see young people being put in the dock, in general, that wasn't what we observed. Where for young adults sitting in the magistrates' courts, in the adult criminal courts, we often saw them being put into the dock. And, you know, I'm sure we've all seen it where a defendant is literally leaning into the crack in the perspex to find out what the hell is actually going on. In terms of the comparison between Crown and Mags Court, I mean, I haven't actually observed Crown Court for about 3 years, but I think what Rabba's just said is absolutely right. I think the fact that the jury is there does suggest something else. And I guess the thing that sticks with me most from doing some work in the young adult court was coming out of court and getting onto a bus, and then noticing that one of the defendants whose case I'd observed was sitting in front of me, and he said to his friend, his friend said, you know, what was it like? And he was like, oh, it was all right. You know, I got off, which I assume meant he didn't get custody for whatever he'd done. And he said, it was a bit weird though. I didn't know who the three people up on the thing were. I was just speaking to the person in front, who I think was the judge. And I assume what he meant was he'd mostly spoken to the legal advisor and had no idea who the magistrates were and what their job was. That's always sort of stayed with me. Obviously it's one anecdote, but it stayed with me as to how effective some people find it, trying to engage with a bench of three people actually is.
If I can just add, I think the responses, all three of those responses to that question about whether it's theatrical, underline so clearly the need for more research with actual court users. And one of the points that happened during the response to COVID, which was immediately this rule that wigs and gowns aren't used in virtual hearings, made me stop and think, well, okay, that might suit the lawyers, but what's it like from the perspective of the lay user, the lay court user? I'm not necessarily suggesting, especially with heat like this, people sit in their living rooms in their wigs and gowns, but perhaps it would have been better for some hearings for at least gowns, perhaps, or bands to be worn by the lawyers, so that when you've got a screen like this with a load of head and shoulders news, there would be at least some sort of visual cue as to who's who a little bit more.
Of course, an
actual hearing where you have people, by virtue of at least in Crown Court, what they're wearing and where they're standing, you have a clue as to who they are.
Yeah, I don't think
just before you come in on that, sorry to interrupt, but before you come in on that, because I wanted to add, there's another question here that relates to that directed to you. So you might be able to answer, deal with the two at the same time. So we have a question from Samantha Faircloth at the University of Birmingham, who's asked whether you think virtual trials are suitable for defendants and witnesses who are vulnerable and how we could identify vulnerability virtually.
Yeah, and I understand why Samantha's asking that, because that we last saw each other at a talk I was giving about how we address mental health difficulties in the justice system that Lee J ran. I mean, just on that point about wigs and gowns, we at Justice have tested the virtual trial 4 times now. The first one we did without wigs and gowns. The feedback we got from the participants, which was everyone who took part, plus the viewers in the public gallery, who we asked to complete a survey, and the observing academics, which were Professor Linda Mulcahy and Dr. Emma Rowden, all said, where are the wigs and gowns? This is a Crown Court trial. Can you treat it with formality and solemnity, please? So we were like, oh, okay, of course. Why aren't we wearing them? So we put those on, and each stage of that process through, we have tried to increase the formality and solemnity of the proceedings. So in the fourth trial, you will see the crest, the court crest, everywhere we could get it, behind the judge, in the jury deliberation, jury community hub, on the screen for the public gallery. Whenever anyone's screen went off, it comes on in their place. And we did, there's an important amount of walkthrough, entrance into the court. What are the stages people go through before they enter the court, and how do we replicate those in an online environment? And because this is an area where we have already been doing that work around the in-person court, the physical court, of course we have put that into the development of what an online procedure looks like. And my concern about what is currently operating in the courts, which Phil referenced in terms of the research that's been done so far, is that I don't think any of that has been taken into consideration. People jump around all over the place because there's no fixed positioning, nobody's labelled. Where is the court backdrop? What introduction do members of the public get before they join the call? How are they introduced to a virtual proceeding? How are they told what will happen, where people will be? It's all very ad hoc, and I think that is concerning, because we've been scrabbling to get this system up and running, and it is being, you know, praised by various people within HMCTS that we do now have courts running. But if those features are not in place, then the experience of that justice system will be even more fragmented and baffling and confusing than the in-person one. So the question about vulnerability, it depends on the person, is the answer. And I think that's the case for whatever kind of layperson it is who's joining the call, and indeed whatever kind of professional it is joining the call. These are case management decisions based on all of the features that we know about each individual. There are people with autism spectrum disorder who will find it far more comfortable to join a hearing like this than have to navigate getting from their house to the courtroom. I always remember a conversation I had with a young woman who intentionally breached her bail so that she would be taken by prison escort to court for her trial, because she was so worried about how to get there on her own. And if she had had this as an option, she wouldn't have needed to be in a police cell, because she would have been comfortable with a digital environment. I don't think we can make any assumptions about what is and is correct for an individual. We need to tell them what their options are and give them a free choice through a ground rules hearing or something similar. And that goes for whoever you are taking part in the process. One thing that really bothers me about the way things are developing as well is a distributed courtroom. Some people on a screen, some people in the room. Anyone who's joined a conference call by telephone or by video, when everyone else is in the room, knows that you just cannot take part in the same way. And I think unless we address that in these distributed courts, we have a fundamental risk of reducing their ability to participate as well.
That's so interesting. Can I just add one point very quickly? And Jodie's right about not making assumptions. It's about different individuals. And even for an individual, I think the picture could be very nuanced. So someone with an autism spectrum disorder, if they think, yes, I'll opt for a virtual hearing because it's easier to do it from my bedroom, for example, rather than go to court. Equally, it might make communication more difficult in the actual hearing unless the proper adjustments are made. And I'm not aware of any research as yet. We know about the difficulties for people with autism spectrum disorder in a real courtroom. I'm not aware of any research that's helped us unpack the complexities of communication in a virtual environment in a courtroom. So yeah, we've got a lot to learn.
I know that Communicourt are starting to do this, and they've been producing some documents on principles of what to take into account. They have certainly found it's possible to do some assessments virtually and to assist some people virtually, I think in the family context, family jurisdiction rather than crime. And I know Intermediaries for Justice have been doing the same thing. But yeah, it's not academic research, it's their experience of it as a practitioner.
Thank you. So we're going to try to get through a couple more questions with the time we have. There's a question for you here, Penny, from Darren Weir at Kent University. On slide 2 of your slides, said it was interesting to note that the lack of research on intermediaries. How is effectiveness measured? How is or can we measure the effectiveness?
Yes. Oh, thanks for that. I saw that in the chat. Well, a year ago, I would have said, just simply, well, if you're going to research intermediaries and their effectiveness, you'd have to look at the legislation where it says they're there to improve the quality of someone's evidence. And what is quality about? It says in legislation it's about complete, coherent, and accurate communication, if I've remembered it right, those three things, complete, accurate, and coherent communication. However, having done this research on participation, and now that we have a 10-point framework for what participation entails and what its functions are, which I won't go through the 10 points now, they're in the book, I'd say that presents a better framework for doing the research. So if you were doing a piece of research with intermediaries, perhaps lab-based, comparing witnesses who have them, witnesses who don't, in a mock trial setting, you'd want to test effectiveness about eliciting information and conveying information, but also well-being and how well that's protected, how much they feel enabled to take part in the decision-making, and whether or not they feel the process is legitimate. So there are lots of other things besides, well, a very narrow view of effectiveness with intermediaries. Is that communication complete, accurate, and coherent? I think there's a much richer picture of participation, which intermediaries are there to support. I hope the intermediaries who are watching would agree with me on that. And that really should be the focus of research into their effectiveness.
Thank you. Always trying to scramble to find the unmute button. I'm going to put a couple more questions to you. I'll put them out broadly for anyone to answer, and I'll have to cut us off a couple minutes before 6 to wrap up. There is a question here that was directed to Rabbi, but I think that all of you will be able to speak on it, saying that this is from Catherine Hollingsworth, professor of Newcastle Law School, that you looked at the various stages of the process but not sentencing. So what reflections do you have or from your experience on participation at sentencing, and is the same framing applicable? Does it change where presumption of guilt changes to a finding of guilt? And or what other considerations are there re-effective participation at that stage? The other question, which I noted, and I'll have to scroll down to find who asked it, so apologies. Here they are. Sophia Hassel, who's an offer holder at LSE. Oh, I hope you will be joining us soon. To what extent do you think that compulsory law/criminal law classes in schools would be an effective solution to bridging the gap between legal professionals and lay users in solving language barriers and so on? And I don't know if Phil, if you have any particular thoughts on that, because obviously the defendants that end up in the youth court will at some point be in school, hopefully. So I'll put those two questions out. I don't know if Rab, if you want to start on the sentence.
Yep.
Just very brief answers, please, because we should have 2 hours for this, really.
So I did consider sentencing and participation during sentencing and then cut it out of my presentation because obvious time limits, and ironically, these time limits transpire again in answering this question. Very briefly, I will say, though, that there is an excellent research paper, I think by Howard Leake for Penal Reform, where they interviewed various participants in the sentencing hearing of proceedings, and it talks about their participation and experiences of participation. If I had to pick one point to quickly make, participation during sentencing is ironic in that it's probably, if you've been convicted, or generally the kind of most severe or important hearing that will happen or potentially happen in the criminal justice process. It's the part of the hearing where you potentially maybe have your liberty restricted for a very, very long time. And yet it is the part of proceedings where often, in fact, quite frequently, the defendant will say absolutely nothing at all. They will just sit in the dock and have it happen. And sometimes you'll have a pre-sentence report, which happens, you know, sometimes within half an hour, whatever it is, where this it's meant to inform the judge of everything about you so they can make an informed decision about the kind of sentence they want to give you, whether it's going to rehabilitate, punish, or focus on something else. And that happens very, very quickly. There's rarely any research. I remember by contrary example being told by US colleagues that some sentencing hearings, certainly in very serious cases, there is a kind of psychiatric assessment of some length. There are like historical information from your own family lineage to determine various pieces of information. It's quite a detailed and substantial process that's very heavily informed for the judge making the decision. I don't know if we have that level of participation in our sentencing hearings. Certainly advocates can make an effort to try and have that happen. But yeah, that's me squeezing all I can in about 3 minutes. Hope it helps.
Thank you. In 30 seconds, does anyone want to take the question on education in schools?
Yeah, I mean, I'll take it very quickly. I mean, I think I've always been an advocate for more public legal education. I think it's really important. I think thinking about access to justice is not just about access to a lawyer, but understanding when you've got a justiciable problem. But unfortunately, I think lawyers can't get out of this. They have to unbundle their language. It's far too complex. Just as doctors and nurses are having to learn how to speak to patients properly, unfortunately, lawyers have got exactly the same challenge ahead of them. And I think sort of expecting schools to solve that problem is probably not going to work. And I actually think the profession has a responsibility.
Can I add on that very quickly? The phrase that springs to my mind is baby barristers, not meant disparagingly. I have been one. It doesn't matter how much class work you get in schools about what the law is and how the law works. While we look up to our senior barristers as people to aspire to in terms of their language, attitude and culture in the courtroom, we are going to keep moulding ourselves as junior barristers to become that person. And that's the problem. It is the leaders in the profession, the judiciary and the senior barristers who need to take the role here that Phil says and start removing this legalese and unnecessary ritual from our cases. I do a lot of mock interviewing for people applying for pupillage or indeed for internships at Justice. And I can see how they sort of put their I'm now pretending to be a barrister hat on, and their normal parlance goes out the window and they stop speaking like sort of automaton baby barristers. And I have to say to them, you know, there's no reason for you to become a robot here. You're most persuasive when you're speaking in language that a jury can understand and that your client can understand, because this is about your client, unless you're in the Court of Appeal or Supreme Court, which you won't be doing when you first start. And in any event, you know, when you get to that appeal, your client still needs to understand what's happening. And I think go back to the thing I said right at the beginning, we have to put lay people at the heart of these proceedings. And until it is about them and not an office in which lawyers work, we aren't going to see that shift.
I think that's a great point to end on, and probably something that all of the speakers would agree with, that putting lay participants at the heart of the proceedings, remembering who these proceedings are about, and who has the most at stake. There are many other questions in the chat which we haven't had time to get through, but one thing that I like about these Zoom events is that people are answering other people's questions and having to go through. So I'm going to wrap up by saying a huge thank you to our four speakers for the excellent presentations, and for everyone who has joined us, especially those, as Penny said, who are in other jurisdictions and crazy times to be coming to these kind of events. I think that this has been a very productive, I hope it's been a very productive and useful set of talks for everyone who has attended. Please join us again the same time next week for part two of this discussion, where we have another excellent lineup of speakers who will be talking about more issues to do with lay participation, including the concept of vulnerability, special support for victims of sexual offences, communication assistance for individuals with intellectual disabilities, and our very own John Taggart will be talking about the role of intermediaries. So thank you again, everyone, for coming, and hopefully see you all next week.